I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. The election in the United Kingdom is this Thursday, and it's been a most memorable and eventful one thus far. For the first time, the leaders have engaged in televised debates, and they've been interesting to watch. I'll ask my guest now, Chris Brower, as to whether they've been successful and consequential. We'll also discuss the campaign days before the vote, whether a hung parliament is a possibility, the recent gaffe by the Prime Minister Gordon Brown, the Labour leader, the emergence of the Liberal Democrats under its leader, Nick Clegg, and how David Cameron of the Conservatives has fared. Chris Brower joins me from here in Canada this morning. He's a social media expert, staff lecturer, and director of online journalism at City University London. He owns Smooth Media International, a creative services business. They create digital media for a global portfolio of clients, and they manage an investment fund at Clarity Capital. The website for more is at smoothmedia.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Chris Brower. Good morning, Mr. Brower.
Morning, Joseph.
Where are you this morning?
I'm actually just outside of Toronto in Guelph, just coming back through Canada after quite a long time doing a number of analysis around the election, so just taking a break after the three televised debates.
Yeah, and so have you been? How long have you been in Canada on this trip?
Just a couple of days now.
So, yeah.
Just made my move over and feel quite detached from all the action over there.
Yeah, is it an election that people in England, because you live there, work there, is it something that they're paying attention to?
Well, it's actually got a lot of energy in the last about 3 weeks, really from the start of the first TV debate. It's been a very interesting climate. It was very lethargic. Very little interest, very little public engagement around the issues. Britain, as so many countries in the world, is so focused at the moment in recovering from the recession and very worried about a double-dip scenario. So the issues that were related to the economy were kind of very key, but otherwise there wasn't a lot of focus on what was happening. And the three-party leaders had really struggled to capture the public imagination. So starting with the first televised debate, the energy levels ratcheted up considerably, and it's been a very exciting time.
Now, this is the first time, as I mentioned, that they've had these debates on TV. We've had them in Canada for years, since, I guess, 1968. The Americans, of course, since the 60s. Has this changed the campaign at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's been phenomenal impact, but a lot of it is difficult to detach from the kind of novelty factor. As you say, they've never had the debates in the UK, which is quite remarkable with the parliamentary tradition and the massive importance of parliamentary prime minister's questions in parliament, and a long history of kind of debate as a foundational aspect of political dialogue. But there's been enormous resistance. The first time was in 1964 when Harold Wilson attempted in the UK to make this happen, and ever since there's just been this consistent trend that the leaders in the polls have resisted the opportunity, and because it's been a kind of an opt-in process and there hasn't been any independent body driving the need for debate, it just hasn't happened. And that's what made this remarkable. Was Cameron was well in the lead in the polls when they announced that they were going to debate, and he came out very boisterously saying, anytime, any place, anywhere. So that was really the fundamental shift, was that the party that was leading in the polls was very eager to engage in this format. And Rupert Murdoch, driving Sky, for example, in the UK, said, well, I'm going to hold these debates, and if any of the leaders don't show up, then we'll just have an empty chair where they were to sit. And there's a lot of pressure this time to make it happen. As a result, the novelty factor and the fact that it's kind of the first time, I mean, last year there were these televised debates in Iran and Afghanistan and Mongolia, for example. So the UK is coming very, very late to this party, and there was a lot of publicity around these events, and the first debate had 10 million viewers, or about a quarter of the voting electorate, watching. There's just been an enormous amount of interest, and subsequent to each debate, the kind of fallout has been driving all of the political campaigns and the discussion points for the week that followed the debate prior to the instigation point of the next debate, which then triggered another week. So really, since the first debate, it's been all about the debates in terms of the political campaign, and it's set the agenda for the shift in the poll. polling results and the overall climate.
And after the first debate, Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrats, he came out. He really drove the campaign, didn't he?
Incredible. I mean, a 13-point swing. They call it the yellow tide. With the colors, you kind of have Labour is red and the Conservatives are blue, and the Liberal Democrats are yellow in the UK, and this kind of yellow tide that took over after the first debate. There was so much discussion going into that debate as to whether Brown or Cameron would win the day, and Clegg was really sidelined. But interestingly, there's a large betting culture in the UK around virtually anything. You can legally bet on any event, including political outcomes and so on. And the bookies had Clegg favored considerably going into that first debate. So they obviously knew something about how this was going to play out. But generally, within the political punditry business, Clegg was seen very much as the outsider and kind of would be add a bit of novelty to the debate, but not the key factor. But then coming out of the debate, it just swung enormously in his favor, and it transformed the entire campaign. Suddenly we had three parties very, very close in the polls, and everybody trying to figure out what the ramifications of that was going to be.
And so now after the third debate, is it... Because after the third debate, all these instant polls, and I'll ask you about instant polls in a sec, but it seems that Cameron has won that. Is that correct? Is that
So it's looking, you know, the third debate, the first debate, Cameron, Clegg decisively won. The second debate was Clegg winning very, very marginally, typically, in most of the polls. And in this third debate, it's Cameron winning marginally over Clegg. So it is gradually Cameron. Everybody was really surprised when David Cameron won the nomination to be the leader of the Conservatives in the UK. He was running third or fourth in the internal party nomination process and wasn't a likely leader. And then he gave a speech, I believe it was in Bournemouth in the South, and at the Conservative Party conference, where he spoke for 45 minutes without any notes. And he spoke very much in the populist rhetorical style of Tony Blair, and he captured the imagination of the Conservative Party in that single moment. Over that 45 minutes, when he finished, then he swung straight into the lead of the candidates to take over for the party, subsequently won the nomination, and everybody has been sort of glowing about his communication, his rhetorical skills, and he's very comparable to Tony Blair in his style and his delivery and the way that he handles himself, very comfortable in that kind of a setting. So I think everybody really expected him to dominate these debates from that perspective. I'm not sure about the policy or the actual issues, but from the style of who had the most style, Cameron was bound to be the winner. But in the first debate, Clegg decisively won that battle, which really surprised everybody and was part of the momentum that started to drive behind him. And by the third debate, you could see David Cameron just getting a lot more comfortable with the format and settling into his stride. And as a result, I think we're starting to see that effect in the polling results.
Is it still a three-way race then?
Well, you know, interestingly, it is. It's one of the very bizarre things that's happening is that the Liberal Democrat support is spread very thinly across the entire country. So they have about equal support. They're running about 30% in most of the polls, and they're kind of running about 30% in almost every riding in the country. So they're sitting in a situation where they're running second in a huge number of ridings. It's about 650 constituencies in the UK in this election, which is more than they've had in the past. They've also reworked the constitutional boundaries, and as a result, there's been some new seats emerging. But there's 650 seats. About 150 of those are battleground seats that are you know, known to be the ones that are going to be decisive in the overall outcome of the election. But Labour has extremely strong support in particular areas of the country, particularly areas that are industrialized and generally working class, and they're dominating in those regions. As a result, Labour's running 27-28% in the polls, but it, you know, may end up with the most seats at the end of this actual election, despite the fact that they're obviously the least popular of the parties. And a lot of people are saying, well, Labour's kind of out of it. But in fact, they're only out of it to the extent that they certainly can't win a majority government, but they may end end up in a position where, as I say, they have the most seats and have the first opportunity to form a government if it ends up in this hung parliament scenario that most people are predicting.
Now, Prime Minister Brown has said that a coalition between Mr. Cameron and Mr. Clegg would derail the economic recovery, among other things. Is that really, if it is a hung parliament, that the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, that they will coalesce rather than the Liberal Democrats would say Labour?
I think, like, Gordon Brown is just tremendously unpopular at the moment in the UK, and that runs the gamut across the general population as well as the political leadership of the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. There's just a lot of dissatisfaction with the kind of energy that he's brought to the process, and the fact that he, you know, he had an opportunity to call elections several years ago. It looked like he was going to do so, and then when the polls started to swing against him, he pulled back, and all the machinery of those two parties were well geared up for the election, the expected call. Didn't happen. There's a lot of resentment that built up over that, the feeling that he was kind of waiting for very pragmatically and sort of ignoring the needs of the electorate in favor of his own agenda to get himself into an elected position as Prime Minister. But, yeah, the general sort of sentiment is that Nick Clegg is going to be in a position to swing his support behind either the Conservatives or the Labour Party. And, you know, it's not yet fully clear. He hasn't officially announced which direction he would go. But it's very unlikely, I would say tremendously unlikely, that there would be a kind of grand coalition between the Labour and the Conservatives in forming a government. So really we're looking at a government formed of the Liberal Democrats and one of Labour or the Conservatives. And in that vein, Nick Clegg seems to have a much better rapport and a stronger affinity with David Cameron. Perhaps not, most people would have expected, Liberal Democrats are generally perceived to be a kind of centre-left political party. So a lot of people would have expected that Labour was a more likely coalition partner for Liberal Democrats. And going into the election, if you had said there was going to be a hung parliament, then you would have expected that outcome. Through the series of debates, it's also been very, very awkward because Gordon Brown has so obviously been courting Nick Clegg in that process. And one of the sound bites that came out of the first debate, which everyone sort of, Gordon Brown has this kind of pattern of doing notoriously awkward public things. And "I agree with Nick" was a kind of thing that ended up on T-shirts all over the UK after the first debate, sort of making fun of the fact that every time Nick Clegg said anything in that first debate, in came Gordon Brown, "Well, I agree with Nick," and on he would go. And Nick Clegg wasn't saying, "Well, I agree with Prime Minister Brown." And he found himself to be sort of being played again as a kind of pawn in that game and really resented that. And subsequently, his language has been much warmer towards the Conservatives. So I think we're looking at that as the more likely outcome in the event of a hung parliament at the moment.
And Mr. Brown had an awkward public moment this week. He was campaigning, and he ran into this woman, Mrs. Duffy.
Yeah.
And he called her a bigot. I guess he was mic'd up, and so the press played that. Was this a game changer for Brown?
Well, you know, a lot of what they were looking for, Labour was really counting on the third TV debate. Gordon Brown, obviously acting as the running the finance, being the finance minister for so long under Tony Blair, and being in a position, if we compare it to the Canadian situation, it's very similar in nature to our previous kind of arrangement with Chrétien and Paul Martin, and Paul Martin kind of in waiting all the time, and then finally when Chrétien steps down, Paul Martin gets that opportunity to assume the leadership, and people, you know, see him quite differently, where they perceive him so strongly as an excellent finance minister. As the actual leader of the party, the momentum just wasn't there. And in the UK, we're seeing a very similar kind of phenomena. He was struggling to capture the public's imagination. He was falling back on the idea that ultimately the economy was it's the economy, stupid, and this was the kind of the concept that was driving everything around what he was going to be. He wasn't a charismatic guy. He freely admitted that, but, you know, trust him with this tremendously delicate economic time. So they were looking to that third debate to be the kind of swing moment for Labour. And all the way through the entire election campaign, they were looking at that. It's the last TV debate. It was on the BBC. It had the widest exposure in the UK, the core issue of the economy being the area that Brown consistently was polling higher than the other two leaders. So they kind of thought, well, this is the opportunity. And then going into that debate to have these events transpire whereby he made such a public humiliation. And it's a typical Brown moment because, again, he just doesn't have that media savvy. So to have this wireless mic clipped onto his suit, it was a Sky News microphone, and Sky News in particular, you know, had that been the BBC, for example, it's not clear how they might have handled that particular issue. But being that it was Sky News, a private corporation, you know, looking very keenly to try to gain exposure wherever possible, they just jumped all over his mistake there. And in talking to the aide, you know, even the entire transcript of that moment where he says, well, who put me in that situation? What was she doing there? You know, like just the obvious kind of confusion internally within the campaign just solidified in a lot of voters' minds that Gordon Brown is just kind of bumbling and constantly struggling to keep up to pace, just a bit of the old bumbler. And he, you know, having such a public moment in that regard and with a woman who was a Labour supporter, so that even his own supporters he's calling bigots, you know, really did. And then to turn up at her house again and then ask her to come out of the house and shake his hand in front of the door and her refusing to do that. So now he's awkwardly standing in front of the house on his own trying to explain what he's doing there. And the kind of sequence of events just constantly reinforcing the idea that he's not really equipped for leadership. And I think that further imprinted that brand in the mind of the public.
And he has a reputation of dropping the F-bomb in the sort. So,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's just not equipped for this media culture. He's a kind of a political leader who perhaps might have been very, very successful 20, 25 years ago when there wasn't this immersive media culture. And the types, the Bill Clintons, the Tony Blairs, the Obamas of the world, who are so comfortable in that type of format and almost have rock star personalities and are able to handle that kind of celebrity that comes with the political exposure. Gordon Brown simply could not be defined in any of those terms, and he's very crude in many ways, and his dealings with people are very crude and straightforward and so on, and he has a history of very awkward dealings with high-level members of even his own party. And prior to this event, there was a number of other events where aides that had previously worked for him announced that he'd come out and had physically abused members of his own staff. And there's a constant running dialogue, which is kind of just that Brown is very, very awkward socially. And as a result of that, makes a constant string of mistakes. And you can't leave him exposed to any opportunity like that, or he'll just put a foot wrong every time he gets that opportunity. And, you know, once again, doing that and so close to the election, it could be critical, but as I say, it's, in a way, it's somewhat irrelevant because the constituencies that Labour are going to win, they're going to win almost no matter what happens, with regardless of everything. They're deep, deep, deep seated Labour constituencies in the UK, and his popularity has dropped probably about as low as it possibly can. And if there was a national vote for Prime Minister, the way that they have a presidential election in the US or in France, for example, then, you know, I'm sure that he would lose that resoundingly. But the fact that this is a parliamentary system and that they'll be voting along party lines, then, you know, Labour can expect to pretty much stay where they are no matter how many mistakes Gordon Brown makes.
How has social media been used in this campaign?
Well, they made a real effort early on. It's been really, you know, they've attempted to mimic. Everybody in the UK looked to the Obama scenario. And again, as I say, this massive contrast between the personalities that are in play. So with Obama, with his kind of rock star image, with his messages of hope and change and the incredible levels of public engagement from people really, really invested in politics to those who wouldn't even have voted previously and so on, all joining in this kind of collective grassroots experience of engagement, made social media very, very successful as a driver because you could organize community events, you could organize fundraising, you had the grassroots mobilization around policy, you had You had the mechanisms to reach out into public areas that you may never have been able to reach out into via both the media and the media as a galvanizing force for people door-stopping. We saw that kind of phenomena. So they looked to that, and in the UK they said, well, we can't be caught. We can't be caught here in a situation where we're struggling to, Labour was looking that they wanted to take the agenda, and Conservative wanted to take the agenda around social media. Lib Dems sat very much in the background around that particular area. And Labour and Conservatives rolled out iPhone apps. They attempted to generate, Conservatives have My Conservatives, to try to generate a kind of a base for mobilization and fundraising and things. But all in all, it's been tremendously unsuccessful. And everybody's kind of pointing to the fact that social media has been a kind of failure in the UK election, which fundamentally this is a TV election. That's what's been clear about it, that the TV debates have completely overshadowed every other form of media, including the traditional barons of print like The Sun or The Mirror, with readerships in excess of 3 million daily readers in the UK, massive daily newspapers on a scale that we don't really have comparable type scenarios in Canada. But those things have also become relatively irrelevant in the face of the kind of the shadow of these TV debates. But social media, from my perspective, has failed not because of the mechanism of social media, but there isn't a brand, there isn't a personality that can be used in that way. And just like any kind of viral kind of concept, the effort to try to turn and mobilize enormous amounts of people at the grassroots level first requires a deep level of interest and engagement and, attraction. And that's where that kind of celebrity culture of those particular political personalities that have been very successful in using social media. Sarkozy in France was also very successful in implementing that, but again had this incredibly magnetic personality. And I think, David Cameron, Nick Clegg, and Gordon Brown, none of them have that kind of magnetic personality and engaging characteristics that the public would be looking for in that regard. So people are engaging in social media, but only the hardcore political activists and only the people who are really, really interested in the particular policies and issues of politics, the people that you would expect to be engaged with the campaign in any rate, at any event. But the ones that they were trying to reach, to try to extend the reach of their political mechanisms, that hasn't been successful at all. And in many ways, they've abandoned any attempts to deploy politics via social media in this election.
Chris, I've enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate this.
It's been terrific, Joseph. I love your site, and you have such a wonderful long history of interviews on there. I'm proud and happy to be part of it.
Thanks very much. The website for more is smoothmedia.com. Chris Brower and Guelph on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.